This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Neighborly by Ellie Monago, performed by Christina Panfilio and Amy McFadden. August 20. Welcome back to GoodNeighbors.net. You have 8 new messages from your neighbors. Looking for a reliable landscaper. Any recommendations? Server at the microbrewery that just opened on Main didn't wash her hands after using the restroom. Free aquarium. Thanks for all the nanny referrals. UAVers rock. You don't want to miss one of the last block parties of the summer. My 3-year-old lost her favorite stuffed bunny. Rip in his right ear. Answers to the name Carrots. Last seen at Shoreline Park. Reward for its return? Chardonnay at our house. Lemonade stand now open at 1340 Griffith Street. Aviers, I have some horrifying news. Last night, one of our own was shot. Details are still emerging, but it looks like the perpetrator was another resident of the AV. At a time like this, we need to lean on each other more than ever. Chapter 1. Welcome to the AV. 2 months earlier. Doug and I grin at each other in surprise and delight. Even Sadie's in on the act. I feel her feet hyperextending joyously as she's suspended against me in the baby Bjorn. I couldn't have imagined anything like this. Who gets welcomed to their new neighborhood with a block party and a 10-foot-tall balloon arch? And yet, it's exactly why we spent everything we had to live in Aurora Village, AV to the locals. They say it takes a village, and Sadie deserves one. Our block is a carefully maintained mishmash of architecture that includes colonials, Mediterraneans, Tudors, Georgians, Victorians, and California craftsmen. Some are original, meaning they're more than 100 years old. Our craftsman is by far the smallest, a bungalow really, but our neighbors don't seem to mind, so I won't either. While the houses might appear to be a random assortment, the trees reveal the AV's covert design. Beech, Japanese maple, jacaranda, birch, cherry, and oak all come together to create an ever-changing seasonal kaleidoscope. The tree canopy above dances like a mobile. There's a flowering pear tree in front of our house, and its fluffy white blossoms take on a silver cast as dusk falls. It's stunning, and I mean that literally. We moved in last week, and I'm still stunned that we get to live here. Good thing I took care of all that move-in trash yesterday. Sure, my methods were unorthodox, but it had to be done. This place is immaculate. It's like that movie, Pleasantville. Only it's already in Technicolor. The sun is high in the sky, radiant yellow against cloudless blue. It's a child's drawing of a day. The air carries the smoke and tang of barbecue. The neighbors must have been waiting for us. Before we've even descended our front steps, there's a round of applause, whoops, and whistles. The children below are bubble-blowing and hula-hooping and playing tag, dogs at their heels. I spy a pogo stick. There's not a handheld device or smartphone in evidence. No video games, no scrolling. It's like we've stepped back in time, except for all the late-model luxury cars, including, in one driveway, matching Porsche Cayenne SUVs. Since it is the San Francisco Bay Area, the landscape is dotted with Priuses. There are some solidly middle-class cars like ours, a Subaru Outback that we bought used before Sadie's arrival and that I now wish we'd thought to wash. Card tables span the block, piled high with homemade appetizers, salads, innumerable bun options, several of them gluten-free, one made from a blend of ground-up seeds, and desserts. I feel guilty that Doug and I don't have some sort of contribution, though I was explicitly told that we were meant to be empty-handed as the guests of honor. While there are plenty of cut-up vegetables and 6 kinds of hummus, the buffet could have used some pretzels, popcorn, or chips. Everything seems so well-organized, nearly military in its precision, that I imagine the absence of snack food is not an oversight. In the AV, I bet there are no oversights, only a consensual choreography.
"Do you think there's a block-wide ban on chips?" I whisper to Doug.
"Maybe someone once choked on a fat-free, low-carb quinoa crisp," he whispers back.
We giggle, loopy with excitement, irrepressibly thrilled to be the newest residents of the 1800 block of Bayberry Lane. Sadie, who at 4 months old, is reveling in her new superpower of controlling her head instead of it lolling around on her neck, strains upward, letting out a giggle of her own. 4 high-end grills are lined up, laden with every variety of organic, grass-fed, free-range meat and, of course, meat substitute product imaginable. A man with appropriately fire-colored hair is moving back and forth among them, alternating between tongs and brushes, a study in male dominance and efficiency. It's a martial arts display. The thought that our neighbors have gone to this much trouble for us is nearly dizzying. Everything we did to get here was 100% worth it. It wasn't exactly a devil's bargain, but it was close. So many people would kill to be in our shoes. Hundreds showed up at the open house for what is now our home, so many that prospective buyers had to enter in shifts, waiting outside like it was an exclusive club, the selling agent acting as bouncer. Now we're on the other side of the velvet ropes. That balloon arch is directly in front of the walkway to our house. The welcome banner is for us. All morning, I could hear the setup happening outside. "Let's move this table," and "How about over here?" and "What do you think of this?" accompanied by laughter. A lot of laughter. I just kept thinking, our neighbors like each other. Please let them like us. Please let them like me. Everyone loves Doug everywhere he goes, effortlessly. He's good-looking, but not intimidatingly so. Tall and well-built, but not six-packed, with brown hair and brown eyes and a ready smile. His wit is quick, yet never scathing. He listens deeply when people talk. He has a gift for making others feel interesting. He engenders goodwill and reminds you there are trustworthy people in the world. I often need that reminder. In large part, I married him for it. And people go nuts for Sadie, with her golden curls and cerulean blue eyes. Whenever we're out, strangers make references to the Gerber baby. I was a true blonde, too, when I was her age. Now my hair is much darker, wavy rather than curly, and my eyes are hazel. Me, I'm passably pretty, but she's prototypically beautiful. Doug is an extrovert, while I've always been slow to warm up. Yet that's about to change. Moving here wasn't just about a new house to go with our new baby. It was about a whole new life. One I'll do my best to meet unguarded, with open arms. At that very notion, my smile wobbles. What if I'm marked in some way that I can't see? What if my life before is indelible, the past written in invisible ink? What if the intensity and purity of AV sunlight will bring it out? As I teeter, our next-door neighbor approaches and hugs me, her arms a wide arc to encompass Sadie, too. Several days ago, she knocked on our door to introduce herself and extend the invitation to today's party. I was so touched by her warmth and kindness that everything flew out of my head, including her name. Since moving in, I've seen her the most of anyone, through our front window. She and her husband are empty nesters with a pair of golden retrievers they walk 3 times a day. She's always wearing workout shorts and microfiber t-shirts. A space-age fanny pack lies extremely flat against a stomach that's also notably flat, but it somehow goes with her look. Her husband is tall and trim, with a shock of silver hair, and I see he's off talking to a cluster of men who I presume to be the block alphas, all dressed neatly in chino shorts and polo shirts, owners of the largest and most renovated houses on the block. These are men who get their lawns serviced professionally rather than simply mown, who work with large sums of other people's money. I try to listen as the woman I think of as Fanny introduces herself to Doug, but just then, Sadie lets out a peal of excitement. Well, Doug will tell me later. He's good at remembering names. "Come with me," Fanny says, taking my hand and leading me forward. "Meet everyone." There are orange cones at either end of the block, which she tells me were put there by the neighbor across the street, Wyatt, who is a police officer. I don't know if it's legal to arbitrarily cordon off his own block for gatherings, but I'm not about to question the Shangri-La before me. A huge bounce house is emblazoned with pictures of Mickey Mouse and friends, and Fanny informs me that the Rileys own and inflate it for every gathering. "Just one of the perks of being on this block." A face painting table is set up with a stool and a five-tiered makeup kit, manned, womaned, actually, by a comely brunette. The little girl on the stool is currently half cat. "That's Tennyson," Fanny says, indicating the painter. "Isn't that a beautiful name?" I murmur my assent, hoping I sound convincing. "Her parents were English professors. She was almost named Coleridge. She lives in house number 1812. Her husband, Vic, will be dressed up like a clown later, making balloon animals. He's a day trader. He's also the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus." No response leaps to mind, so I just nod, smile, and wipe at Sadie with the burp cloth that's tucked into the Bjorn. I'm on constant drool patrol. A children's soccer game is being organized on an expanse of emerald lawn. Meanwhile, chalk is laid out on the sidewalk for the artistically inclined. Younger kids play harmoniously with older ones. It's unclear which are family members and which are simply neighbors, since a deep familiarity exists from the youngest to the oldest, kids and adults alike. People move easily among different clusters, with shoulder pats and laughter. It's so different from our last neighborhood where we'd rented for years, just 20 minutes away in downtown Oakland, with anonymous bustle and bars and nightclubs. That was pre-Sadie, and this, the AV, is definitely post. This is where I want to be. These people, they're who I want to be. While I've never been as outgoing as Doug, I'm sure I can hold my own. It's just that I haven't done much socializing since Sadie came along. I'm a little rusty, that's all. This is going to work out. It has to. We did what was necessary to get here, because that's how it is once you have children. You make sacrifices so they can have the best lives possible. But that feeling in my stomach is more than a pit. It's the whole peach. I almost wish I still drank. A glass of wine might sand my slightly jagged nerves. I can't help noticing that there's plenty of white wine and champagne on ice in what appear to be expensive silver buckets. Several coolers are full of juice boxes and milk for the kids, while another is yawning open full of beer. I haven't had any alcohol in more than a year, not since before I was Sadie's incubator, and now I'm her main food source. For the first time, I seriously consider a pump and dump, but I've always hated the idea of anything going to waste. Doug's already grabbed a Sam Adams and is taking in his surroundings with a huge smile. I need to find my next someone to talk to. The vibe is incredibly friendly, and I've got my own balloon arch. There's nothing to worry about. I just need to look around and leap. By and large, the clusters are gender-specific. Doug joins a male minion, and I scan the quorums of women. I notice how variously dressed they are, yet so easily commingling. This isn't like high school, where the social organization is by type. Jocks with jocks, brains with brains. Here, I can't tell who the popular kids are. The vast majority of women appear to be in their 30s through late 40s, so in that way, I fit right in at 34. Some are in Lululemon, others are outfitted from REI, like they just got done with a hike. There are lots of sundresses. A few women are done up like real housewives, in high fashion, with perfect coiffures, and full makeup and expensive jewelry. There are a couple of pairs of frumpy knee-length shorts, and one woman wears cat's eye glasses with a retro print romper, an arty tattoo vining along her arm and up her neck. There are different body types, some much more toned than others, but obesity seems to have been outlawed. Two obviously pregnant women are chatting with each other, mirror images, each rubbing her belly in slow, concentric circles. Women spend their lives trying to set up a certain image, through their clothes, their hair, their shoes, that will serve as a dog whistle for other women of similar ilk. Me, I've always been a career-minded, quasi-intellectual, taking pride in my work. I'm happy to see the New Yorker magazine in the dentist's office, but never subscribe. I aim to look reasonably attractive, but not like I've spent too much time to get there, with wedge heels and never stilettos, in the requisite cute top and jeans, loath to take any risks with bold accessories. I don't want to call too much attention to myself. I'm just hoping to blend in. It seems like a low bar, but at a glance, it's not at all obvious to me where I fit. That I will fit. As I'm scanning the crowd anxiously, I'm set upon by two men. They're both tall, but that's where the similarities end. One has a baby face, silky blonde hair, a neatly trimmed beard, and is wearing a pair of jeans and a plaid button-down. The other is craggily handsome, his hair dark with filaments of gray, his muscles on full display in a tank top and tight shorts, his arms tattooed from shoulder to wrist in bright colors, like exotic plumage. I'd guess there's at least a 15-year age difference between them, maybe even 20. "Hey there, I'm Brandon and he's Stone," the older tattooed man tells me with a broad smile. "Congratulations on the house. Welcome to the hood. We're so excited to meet you." He leans down to get a better look at Sadie. She preens for him prettily, a flirt at 4 months. "Look at this little one. So gorgeous. We need another pronto." Stone's smile says he's happy being background to Brandon's foreground.
"She is a beauty."
"Thanks," I say. "Have you met Oliver yet?" Brandon asks me. I shake my head. "He lives in that perfectly restored Victorian over there. When Stone and I first moved onto the street, I couldn't stop laughing." I must look perplexed because he points to the Victorian. "Oliver," and then to his partner, "Stone." I laugh. "This one," he says, gesturing to Stone again, "calls me Bran." "Doesn't Stone Bran sound like a remedy for the worst constipation you ever had?"
"Stone and Bran should have an Esquire at the end," Stone says, mildly corrective.
"I've always felt we're more of a variety show," Brandon counters. "We're like the Mandrell sisters." "When I first said that, Stone had no idea who they were. Do you know who they are?" I indicate no, and he does an exaggerated sigh. "You young folk, no sense of history." I can tell this is a routine they've done before, but I don't mind. I like them. "Enough about us. I want to hear all about you," Brandon says. "It's Katrina, right?" He pauses to mug for Sadie, who coos appreciatively. "Yeah, but I go by Cat." "I love Cat. So spunky." I want to live up to that billing, but nothing comes to mind. "What do you guys do?" Ugh. Could I have seemed any less spunky and more conventional?
"I'm in one of those finance jobs no one wants to hear about," Stone answers, "and he's creative."
"I've always got a project going on. I've constantly got to beautify myself or Zoe or the house. I'm a 50s housewife trapped in the body of George Clooney." Brandon dimples. "A much younger, more attractive George Clooney." He glances over to where Doug is engaged in energetic conversation. "Speaking of good looks, can I just tell you, that husband of yours..." He does a little wolf whistle. "Thanks. He's a great guy." I wonder if Brandon's thinking that Doug is too handsome for me, suddenly self-conscious about my new size 8 body. Before Sadie, I was a 4. Doug and I used to be better matched. Physically, that is. Special delivery!
A voluptuous woman in a halter dress walks up, holding the hand of a lovely child, dark-haired and dark-skinned and dark-eyed. Sadie's precise opposite. I'd guess Zoe is between 1 and 2 years old, walking semi-steadily on plump legs.
Yolanda!
Brandon plants a kiss on the woman's cheek.
You're a lifesaver. Where was she?
In a flower bed.
Always with the flower beds.
He lifts Zoe high in the air as she giggles. Yolanda recedes before I can officially meet her, but I have a feeling I will eventually.
It's all fun and games until somebody loses their tulips.
Sadie stretches her arms as if to say to Brandon, pick me up too. I do some knee bends to give her a ride of her own. I fear her fussiness. We're trying to make an impression here. Brandon says,
the thing I love about these parties is the freedom. Everyone watches everyone else's kids. You can just take off and be an adult for a while.
I don't know that I'll ever be able to just take off. I can't picture not knowing that Sadie's in a flower bed. But I love that I'm entering a world where people look after one another and each other's children. It's an enclave of trust and safety. I've never had that before, not even as a kid. Definitely not as a kid.
There you are.
Tennyson, the sexy face painter, comes up to join us.
Leave it to Brandstone to monopolize the guest of honor.
Brandon gives her a side hug. She has a beer bottle sweating in her hand, and I eye it enviously. It's not the only thing I envy, since her body is incredible. She's tan and fit, in a short black cat suit that is at once completely ridiculous and entirely flattering on her. Her face isn't traditionally pretty. Her eyes are close together, and her lips are thin. But she just oozes good health and self-confidence.
I'm Tennyson.
I'm Kat.
Love that.
She swigs from her bottle and wipes her mouth with the back of her hand. A few stray brown strands escape her carelessly perfect bun. I have the sense that she's at least 40 or even 45. Her sort of confidence feels like it's grown into, but her smooth skin belies this.
How are you settling in?
Pretty well. It's not exactly true. I've done as much unpacking as I can, but there's still so much building and assembly for which I have to rely on Doug. Handiness is not my forte. Tennyson lowers her head so she's level with Sadie. She strokes Sadie's hair, then closes her eyes rapturously.
I miss this age.
Sadie reaches out and grabs one of Tennyson's complicated dangling earrings.
No!
I admonish, trying to sound just the right amount of firm. It has no effect. I work to remove the earring from Sadie's grasp, and she starts crying.
Sorry.
I know I shouldn't feel embarrassed. She's just a baby. Tennyson is laughing.
No worries. I remember this age.
She's putting everything in her mouth, right?
Dropping things 12 times in a row so you'll pick them up.
The world's just one big experiment in cause and effect, I say.
That's a cool way to put it.
Sadie's stopped crying, thankfully, and is just studying the throng around us in fascination. She hasn't been in a crowd for a long time, not since I fled the mom's group.
You look at that baby girl, Brandon says, and you know you need another.
I'm definitely not saying that,
Tennyson responds.
My IUD is staying right where it is. Thank you.
You know who I've heard is trying for another?
Brandon looks around and hooks a thumb in the direction of a tall redhead I haven't yet met.
After that labor of hers? Color me shocked.
You're such a gossip,
Tennyson laughs.
I don't repeat any true secrets. I mean, you were going to find that out sooner or later anyway.
Brandon makes a convex motion with his hands to indicate a pregnant belly. When it comes to your children, I say, you forget the pain so fast. They both give me curious looks. I mean the pain of labor. I have the sense of being out of sync, that they were speaking lightly and I went heavy. I try to paper over it by asking Tennyson, which kids are yours?
A woman must have overheard because she joins our conversation with a laugh like music. She's short, her brown hair in a low-maintenance page boy, wearing a plain tank top and jeans and holding a thumb-sucking toddler in her arms.
Which kids aren't hers?
The phrase could seem barbed, yet her delivery is pure honey. She's instantly endearing, with a round, childlike face and simple wire-framed glasses. She even smells innocent, like some sort of throwback soap. Do they still make ivory? Tennyson has a scent that's a little bit musky and a little bit spicy. Cardamom, maybe? It doesn't even seem like a perfume, more like an emanation. Tennyson points to the massive colonial that's directly across the street from my house. I've seen bands of teenagers trooping in and out of there since we arrived, but hadn't yet met the parents. Yeah, we're the Brady Bunch. Vic had 4 from his marriage, I had 3 from mine, and we had 1 together in a bout of total irresponsibility.
You're the Brady Bunch, and she's the Gerber baby,
the other woman says, her soft voice going even softer as she regards Sadie. Then she smiles at me.
I'm Raquel, and this is my little one, Meadow. We live in 1805. We're the ones who need to take better care of our lawn.
It's a good shorthand. Ironically, Meadow lives in the only house with a patch of cappuccino-colored grass on the entire street.
Why don't you just spray paint it? That's what they do at some of the condo developments, Brandon says.
He and Tennyson laugh with a clear note of superiority. I realize that Stone has slipped away, and a few minutes later, Brandon does too. But their absence is quickly replaced by another woman who joins us, and another, and another, and another. Throughout the conversation, they take turns fawning over Sadie, and she's in heaven, surrounded by all those admiring eyes. It's like she already relishes the impact her beauty has on people. Cause and effect, indeed. I instantly forget everyone's names. In response to their questions, I tell them that I'm an assistant provost at a state college on an extended maternity leave. They're all stay-at-home moms, except for one who works part-time as some sort of consultant, and Tennyson, who owns a boutique on the AV's main drag. I do a lot of smiling and nodding until a topic comes up that legitimately piques my interest.
Niels and Ilsa weren't really here that long, Raquel drops.
She gestures toward my house.
I was so surprised when they decided to leave. Their son was only 7. I don't even think they left the Bay Area, did they?
She seems genuinely confused that they'd want to raise their son anywhere else.
I think they just wanted to cash in, Tennyson says quickly,
as if eager to end the speculation.
They bought, what, 3 years ago?
And they probably turned a massive profit. I'm surprised that they're so casually discussing Niels and Ilsa's finances, and by extension, mine. I feel my face reddening. But if they really wanted to cash in, why didn't they take the highest offer? A woman with hair shaped like a mushroom cap, Regina, I think, turns to me like I should have the answers. They must have known Niels and Ilsa better than I did. As far as I was concerned, the former owners were just names on the paperwork. The people to whom my realtor submitted our offer along with a beseeching letter. The unknown masters of our fate, and now, the purveyors of our good fortune.
You weren't the highest offer?
Tennyson gives me an admiring look. No, I say, a little bit proud, and then a little bit embarrassed at my pride. The whole conversation feels askew somehow, but I think that's just because we're culturally conditioned not to talk about money. In some company, it seems more taboo than sex, more intimate. As I tip my head back to underscore my confidence in spite of my mild discomfort, my eye catches on a man who is standing apart from everyone, motionless, his face and body tense. He's sinewy, with a receding hairline and ruddy skin. He's staring at our group, his eyes slightly narrowed. I feel my own body tense. A response as involuntary as a bouncing knee reflex from a rubber mallet.
That's my husband, Bart, Raquel says,
like his behavior is nothing out of the ordinary. Maybe he's just an intense guy.
Or maybe he is entirely normal and my subconscious is just sending up flares. She jiggles Meadow in her arms.
You'll meet him at some point.
I'm kind of hoping not.
So how did you beat out higher offers?
Tennyson brings my attention back with her surprise, as if I've climbed Everest or cracked the double helix. I force my eyes away from Raquel's husband, though he seems like someone I don't want to turn my back on. I wrote a letter to Niels and Ilsa, I say, and I included a picture of Sadie with a homemade onesie that said AV or bust. I regret it the second it leaves my mouth. Using Sadie like that just seems so cheap. Yet the smiling faces before me register complete comprehension. You do what you have to do to get into the AV. We're on our own little island, jutting out into the bay, just minutes from Oakland and San Francisco. Low crime, every school a 10, and you can smell the brine in the air. What wouldn't you give to raise your kids here? Regina wrinkles her nose slightly.
Was it really just a letter and a picture? Ilsa and Niels weren't exactly sentimental people.
They were a little cold, Raquel allows, with the air of someone who doesn't like to speak ill of others. No, it wasn't just a letter and a picture. It was also an offer $450,000 over asking, the kind of offer we could never have made without Doug's parents. A debt we'll be paying off for the rest of our lives in more ways than one.
Well, on that note, I guess we have to do it.
Tennyson releases a dramatic sigh.
It's the inevitable conversation.
Real estate. Regina fills in the blank.
The way this place has exploded. New money and old money. The people who've been here forever, the newcomers, the ones who inherited like Wyatt and Yolanda and everyone in between.
It's pretty strange, Raquel says, to suddenly be sitting on a gold mine. It used to just be a house.
A house on the best block of the best neighborhood, Regina says passionately. I mean, there's no other place like it. Some people have more money, some people have less, but there's no tension, no conflict, no artifice, no heirs, only community. Where else can you find that?
She pauses to position her soapbox.
The AV isn't quite city, and it's not quite suburban. You can walk to great stores and restaurants and to the beach. You can bike along miles of trails, yet you can always find parking on your street. It's the best of everything. It's transurban.
She says it like the term just occurred to her, but then a man passing by, her husband presumably, outs her.
Going on again about the whole transurban thing?
She laughs and swats at him. While I'd never state anything as forcefully as Regina, she's right. The AV is rare. Neighborhoods tend to be homogenous. Everyone has great wealth, or no one does. But here, you have houses of vastly different sizes on the same block. Used Subaru Outbacks beside Porsches. Hedge fund managers next to normal people like Doug and me. He's a senior market analyst, so his field is about as lucrative as mine, which is to say, not terribly. It's everything I never had growing up. Good schools, a community full of warmth and kindness, and above all else, safety. I'm going to make sure nothing happens to this little dangling bundle of mine. But I have to admit, the AV is not diverse in all ways. I'm looking at a sea of white faces, an alabaster undertow.
Meadow says, "Potty now!"
And Raquel excuses herself, heading toward her brown-lawned Georgian. I notice that her husband is following, and I feel a tightness in my stomach, like we shouldn't leave them alone together, which is crazy because they're married. They're behind closed doors all the time.
It's not quite the best of everything, Tennyson says, her face suddenly somber.
We all look at her expectantly. I'm the most worried of all. A part of me has been waiting for the catch ever since we went into escrow.
You can't park just anywhere on the street.
She indicates the open spot in front of a rambling Victorian with peeling green paint, the closest this block has to an eyesore. I laugh the loudest, the most relieved.
I met her, I say. Well, I didn't exactly meet her.
She came out to yell at Doug and me about not parking in front of her house, when we'd actually just parked on the opposite side of the street in front of our house.
You're Gladys's worst nightmare. A craftsman couple with two cars and no garage. You're a threat, Tennyson informs me with a grin.
Doug and I had laughed about Gladys, not that we knew her name. We called her the old crone and the local color. The eccentric everyone has to put up with, who's probably lived here forever and who'll undoubtedly die here. The one bad apple, the exception that proves the rule. Gladys keeps this place from being too good to be true.
She doesn't even own a car, Tennyson says, but she wants a space available in case someone visits her.
She rolls her eyes. Which is practically never, Gina says. It's kind of sad, really. A handsome man with gelled curls and wolf blue eyes comes up behind Tennyson, snaking his arm around her waist and whispering in her ear.
It's too early, Tennyson says. Wait until after we eat.
She looks at the rest of us.
He can't wait to get in his clown suit. It's a shame it's not something plush. Then at least I'd get a little kink out of it.
Vic lets go of Tennyson, a bit reluctantly, it seems, and extends his hand to me.
Good to meet you. Cat, right? I was just talking to your husband. Great guy. We're really glad you're both here.
Thanks, I say. We're really glad we're here, too. He slips back into the crowd. I have a sense the spell has been broken. The inevitable conversation is over, and everyone is considering their next move. If they disperse, where will I go? I look around and see that Doug is headed my way, his plate piled high. He's always the first at a buffet, with utter unselfconsciousness.
For you, he says. Do you want to give Sadie to me for a while so you can relax and eat?
The other women seem impressed by his solicitousness. There are introductions all around. Doug takes Sadie from me, and a new crowd forms around us, all couples. Some of them have plates, but those who don't are happy to accept Sadie, saying that Doug should eat too, since he's the guest of honor. It's Sadie's first time crowd surfing, and she clearly loves it. Having all these new people to bewitch by looking into their eyes, touching their faces, and trying to put anything she can into her mouth, what more could she ask for? I work to quell the slight anxiety that I feel. After all, this is why we came. This is the village. It is nice to actually focus on eating. To not just scarf, but to relish. I do that so rarely, and this food is so worthy. The ribs are succulent, alongside an arugula fennel salad with mandarin oranges, some sort of marinated greens, and homemade cornbread. Doug quickly fills a plate for himself, and then between bites of barbecued chicken, deviled eggs, and potato salad, he fields questions about the new house.
Kat has all these amazing decorating ideas, he says. Have any of you heard of the tiny house movement?
Heads shake no.
There's this network we call THN, for Tiny House Network, because every show is about building and decorating your tiny house. And most of them are way smaller than ours, like 300 square feet. We've got 960. We're huge!
Everyone laughs. It's true. I have been pretty obsessed with THN ever since our bid was accepted. It's where I could find a whole spate of shows to validate our decision. On one, an eco-friendly host announces that tiny houses are the next big thing, and I like that. It's not that Doug and I couldn't afford a larger house. It's that we're part of a movement with a shared ethos to pare down to your own personal essentials. It's about figuring out what you truly value, about having less and doing more. It's not about possessions, but about living fully. Yet that trash mound in front of our house told a different story. Thankfully, it's gone.
So Kat DVR'd, like, every episode of every show on the THN. Doug continues. She got really inspired. And she was most excited about stairs. Under the stair storage. Pull out drawers built right into the staircase. Steps turned into bookshelves. Every day I'd come home and there would be another idea about a flight of stairs.
I never even thought before of how pretty that expression is,
a flight of stairs. It's like a flight of fancy, you know? I say, because I feel like I should be contributing, that Doug and I should be like Stone and Brandon, a variety show, a vaudeville act. But either my timing is off or my tone. I can see that despite my hopeful, you know, our audience doesn't know. I feel my face growing hot, and I stuff it full of cornbread.
So you know how it is in this market, Doug continues, and they turn into bobblehead dolls.
That they know.
It's like pandemonium, and there are so many people at the open house, and our agent is like, hurry up, write the offer, bid high, waive your contingencies. You barely have time to even look around. You're just eyeballing all these people, your competition, and you're in a frenzy. Did you guys see the hordes spilling out onto the sidewalk, frothing at the mouth? It's like we'd all been let out of the zoo or an asylum.
He pauses for audience appreciation. He's flattering them. Who doesn't like to think they have what other people want? Sunday open house was probably like game day, watching the masses with a beer and some chips. Well, maybe not chips. They probably had a vibe about who they liked. Maybe they even saw Doug, Sadie, and me. Were they rooting for us? Did they want us on their team? Doug smiles at me.
So, when we finally get into the house, we're walking around, taking it all in, saying, this is it. This is where we live. We made it. And then I see Kat is standing frozen in front of our stairs, and she just looks crushed, like totally defeated. In all our daydreaming, we sort of forgot our house is more like a split level, but with only two levels. We've got five steps, and each one is yay tall.
He pantomimes the distance.
No under the stair anything for us. Back to the THN drawing board.
Everyone finds him charming, and he is. But I wish he hadn't spent so long underscoring our mini house and my preoccupation with stair storage. Yes, the houses on this street are of different sizes. It's one of the cool aspects of the AV. But even the next smallest house to ours is probably double our square footage. Also, listening to Doug has taken me back to the thud in my chest the day I thought we'd made a big mistake. We'd come out of the purgatorial escrow and gotten our keys. We pushed open the front door, electrified with excitement, and looked around. Really looked around. We had seen the house only that one time, when we had to assume that if everyone wanted it, it was worth having. Then we were in a bidding war, waiving all inspection contingencies and writing sycophantic letters and pimping out our newborn. And then we were exultant. We were winners. Who doesn't want to be a winner? After that, fantasy and THN took over. But staring around at the reality of the unstaged living room, I realized how much I had forgotten, or rather, how much we'd never had the time to register. Like the five crummy little steps. Like the hardwood floors that needed a polish at minimum, and the largest space in the house that would encompass our living room at one end and dining room at the other, which featured the galaxy's cheapest aluminum blinds to keep us from looking directly into our neighbor's house. Why were random wires protruding from a floorboard? Was that a loose brick in the non-operational fireplace? I also realized anew the fact that I'd conveniently overlooked. 960 square feet with two bedrooms was actually smaller than the one bedroom in which we'd been living. This was, indeed, a tiny house, and a well-worn one at that. No, well-loved. It's the Velveteen Rabbit of houses, I told Doug. We smiled and clasped hands in silent agreement. There would be no looking back. Sadie's been passed around enough by this point. She's starting to let out little protest cries. I reattach her to me via the Bjorn, and she immediately starts to fuss in that way that makes me think she could use a diaper change and some milk, maybe some homemade carrot puree. The introvert in me would like a break from all the socializing anyway. I tell Doug that I'm going inside for a bit, but just as I'm stepping onto the sidewalk in front of our house, I'm nearly run over by the 16-year-old goth girl who lives next door to us with her mother, June. I can remember June's name because it's the same as the current month, the one in which we moved into our dream house.
I'm going out and you can't stop me,
the teenager yells. June doesn't even notice me. She's so busy giving chase.
Take my car keys. I don't give a fuck. I'll find another way.
They both round the corner and I see June grabbing her daughter's arm roughly. I avert my eyes, realizing that others are doing the same. June seems friendly but distracted, like her head is permanently turned around on her neck, seeking out her wayward daughter. Every time I've seen her, she's been racing in and out of the house, giving off the fumes of the desperately late, or maybe just the desperate. Mother and daughter don't look anything like each other. June has curly auburn hair and blue eyes, and she's in a pair of jeans and a pretty floral top with spaghetti straps. She's no Tennyson, but she's definitely attractive. The daughter's face is covered in white paint, and she has piercings in her lip and nose. She dresses head to toe in black. Her hair is also black, with electric blue streaks. She has her own Audi and frequently tears out at far too high a speed for a residential street. I've seen June on the sidewalk, shaking with impotence in her daughter's wake. I'm pretty sure there's no husband. I hadn't noticed June at the party earlier, but I'd seen her contribution, a few store-bought pies. People were joking about it, but in a nice way, like it was one of June's charming peccadillos. I take another step toward my house.
You're not leaving already, are you?
Gina asks. Just going inside for a while, I say. Sadie needs to eat.
Don't worry, Tennyson sing-songs. You can just whip them out.
I feel a twinge of shame, caught red-handed. I'm not able to breastfeed. Since Sadie never latched, it's pumping only. I'm not hiding my boobs. I'm hiding the fact that Sadie won't drink from them, which sometimes still feels, irrationally, I know, like a kind of rejection. I force a laugh. I'm going to keep some things private just a little while longer.
There are no secrets in this neighborhood.
Tennyson winks. I realize she's past tipsy, and maybe it's true that there are no secrets, because she's not trying to hide her drunkenness at all. See you soon, I tell her, and then walk up the porch steps. That's when I notice the rectangle of cardboard. It's from the boxes of our new dining room chairs, with their disappointingly wobbly legs like a colt that hasn't yet matured. I thought I'd gotten rid of all that cardboard yesterday. But no. A piece of it is right here, in front of our door, positioned like a welcome mat. That wasn't very neighborly of you. Chapter 2. What does that mean? What wasn't neighborly? There's no one I can ask. The note is anonymous. I shut the front door behind me and lock it, holding Sadie tight. From where I'm standing, I can take in the whole first floor. The living room yields to the dining room with a corner office nook, and then on through the kitchen where a door leads to the backyard. We painted every room a different bright color because this will be a happy place. A yellow kitchen, a red dining room, a blue office nook, a green bedroom for Doug and me, and a purple nursery for Sadie. It's my tiny home. Our tiny home. Happy is the life we're meant to have here in this neighborhood. And we will, that note notwithstanding. Someone was probably just drunk. That's all it was. Or kids were playing a prank. Next, they'll toilet paper our house. It's just innocent throwback fun. I make my way into the kitchen to get Sadie's bottle from the fridge. In my preoccupation, I slam my shin into a heavy box. That's something they don't highlight on THN. All the bumps and bruises you'll incur while adjusting to your Lilliputian house. Inside the box is my new desk, still awaiting assembly. The one with almost impossibly small dimensions that we bought to fit into my undersized office nook. I wish Doug would hurry up and get this house done. I wish he were here, right now, to give me a hug and tell me we have a block full of awesome neighbors and not to let some silly note give me any pause. In the living room, there are two striped love seats facing each other, because we couldn't fit sofas,
and I take a seat on the one facing the door. I cuddle Sadie as she sucks hungrily, obliviously, at her bottle. Some styrofoam has already found its way onto my skirt, and I try to bat it away, but it clings resolutely. While Doug and I scraped together enough money to buy essentials like love seats, we had to skimp on some other things. Our house is full of particle board furniture with nearly impenetrable instructions and bolts, nuts, and screws that get everywhere. Doug's job is building, and mine is trash removal. I scurry in his wake, picking up plastic wrapping, cardboard, and of course that infernal styrofoam. I can't wait until this house is fully assembled, until I can sink into the love seat with Sadie and croon in her ear, "We're home, little one." That's what keeps me up at night, fixating on things like the replacement part that's in transit to finish Sadie's dresser. So much depends on delivery schedules and on Doug's marginal building skills. As handy as he's not, I'm worse. He's also a procrastinator. I've definitely got my character flaws, but that's not among them. On an early date, Doug and I asked each other questions that we had to answer immediately, automatically, with no time to craft an appealing persona. It went like this. Him.
What are you best at?
Me. Making to-do lists and knocking them out. Him.
What are you worst at?
Me. Relaxing. What are you best at? Him.
Reading people and giving them what they want.
Me. What are you worst at? Him.
Getting anything done before the 11th hour.
He wasn't kidding. It's not that I enjoy being in constant motion. It's that what I want most is to relax, and I can't allow myself relaxation until everything's done. Since Sadie, everything can never be done. In a sense, it's my worst nightmare, this Sisyphean life. Yet she offers the greatest reward. She forces me to sit and rock her and smell her hair, and for that, I am profoundly grateful. The cheap metal blinds are shut, and the house is cool. I watch Sadie's eyelids droop. I love when she falls asleep on the bottle, in my arms. It's the most complete happiness I've ever felt. Sadie in my arms is incredibly soporific. I begin to drift away. Then I'm jarred awake by knocking on the front door. I don't know how much time has passed. Sadie's still asleep, dead weight in my arms. I just need to stay quiet and whoever it is will go away. They'll leave us in peace. The knocking stops and I let out my breath in a whoosh. I don't need to go back out there. It's a thought that's at first comforting and then sad. I was having fun at the party. I don't want to stay away just because of some lame handwritten note on cardboard. I don't want to have to build my walls up again. I hear a key turning in the lock and I freeze. It's only Doug. My entire body loosens as I see him. But it's not only Doug.
"Hey," he says. "There are some people I really want you to meet."
It takes me a second to realize that he means right then, as in right behind him.
"I wanted Wyatt to try some of the Talisker," he says. "And Yolanda hasn't gotten a chance to meet you yet."
The three of them step across the threshold. Despite my poor name recall, Yolanda is unforgettable. She was the one who returned Zoe to Stone and Brandon, the one oozing out of her halter dress. Now I bet that woman can breastfeed half the state. She has an absolutely beautiful face with pale, luminous skin and eyes like emeralds. Her hair is long and blonde, and her blowout is starting to frizz, but it just makes her look softer somehow, more touchable.
"Are you sure it's okay?"
she asks, sotto voce because of Sadie.
"Definitely," I say, mustering a smile. "Come in. Sadie can sleep through anything."
Sometimes that's true. At other times, just a shaft of light can blow a whole afternoon. But I have a feeling she's going to stay down this time. I wish I'd changed her ripening diaper before giving her the bottle. She teaches me 1,000 little lessons a day. Doug walks in, swaggers, really, and I can see that he doesn't need that Talisker. He's pretty buzzed already. Wyatt and Yolanda enter much more tentatively behind him.
He goes to raise the blinds, and I gesture toward Sadie, so he turns on a lamp instead.
"Pardon our mess," he yells as he goes into the kitchen. "We're under construction."
I hear the clink of a bottle against the glass. He's clearly not worried about waking Sadie with all that racket, but I don't want to chastise him in front of our new neighbors. I'm not in the mood for company, still bleary from my nap and a little self-conscious about the state of the house, but Wyatt and Yolanda do seem really lovely. Wyatt has a sweet, aw-shucks manner that I wouldn't have expected from a police officer. He'd be tall, dark, and handsome, except that his features seem a few centimeters off, like he's a poor reproduction of a classic painting. "Please, have a seat," I say, gesturing to the love seat across from me. There's packing material on the floor and book boxes that I can't empty until Doug bolts the shelves to the wall, since we're in earthquake country. The non-operational fireplace has become a repository for all sorts of detritus, and the mantle is laden with measuring tape, a hammer, nails, and other random tools. Doug already apologized for our mess, and there's nothing I can do about it now, but still, I'm aware of it.
"I love how colorful it is in here," Yolanda says.
She and Wyatt take the love seat opposite Sadie and me, and she casts an appreciative glance around.
"We are surrounded by white walls. It's so sterile, you know?"
"How long have you lived in your house?" I ask.
6 years, Wyatt says. "It was a gift from Yolanda's parents."
"Not exactly a gift," she corrects. "It's my inheritance."
"Lucky ducks," Doug calls out.
It's a rare social blunder, I think. Doesn't inheritance imply both her parents are dead? But neither Yolanda nor Wyatt seem offended. Doug carries in 3 glasses of whiskey on a plastic cutting board.
"Couldn't find a serving tray," he says apologetically. "Kat, do you want an iced tea or anything?"
"No, thanks, I'm good." After everyone has their drinks, Doug puts the cutting board on the floor and sits down next to me. He leans back, his arm across the width of the cushion, and he looks down at Sadie and up at me with a slow grin. I'm not used to this posture from Doug, his version of a man spread. But then I see that Wyatt is already sitting this way with Yolanda. The phrase social butterfly never quite fit Doug. He's always been more of a social chameleon.
"We should paint our house like this," Yolanda says to Wyatt. "Bring in some color."
"Sure," he answers amiably. "Color's good."
Yolanda looks at Sadie.
"I don't know if I've ever seen a more beautiful baby."
Then we're off and running. We talk babies, while Wyatt and Doug talk whiskey, followed by the Golden State Warriors and the NBA playoffs. Doug must have given Yolanda a pretty stiff pour because she becomes confidential quickly. She tells me about multiple rounds of IVF before she was able to have their twins, who just turned 2 a few months ago.
"Bran's watching them now," she says. "We tag team. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, but sometimes you just need a break. It can be exhausting having 2.
She runs her hand along the shaft of her hair, smoothing it. "I can only imagine. It's exhausting having 1.
I used to be in pageants, if you can believe it."
This seems apropos of nothing, except perhaps a sudden bout of insecurity. I've noticed that Wyatt is always touching her back, or arm, or shoulder like she needs constant validation. "I believe it."
"I'm talking way too much," she indicates her empty glass and says, "I'm such a lightweight."
Then she laughs self-consciously.
"That's one term that doesn't usually apply to me. Not anymore."
"I've put on weight, too, since having Sadie."
"You look great."
There's a peculiar note of accusation in it, and I'm glad when she changes the subject.
"I think about going back to work sometimes. Do you?"
"I don't just think about it. I am going. In about 2 months. I feel a rush of sadness, looking down at my beautiful, sleeping girl in my arms.
"Part-time?"
"No. Full." To my surprise, I'm on the verge of tears.
"Then don't go," Yolanda says sympathetically.
She's trying to help, but doesn't she get that it's not always a choice? For me, it's a necessity. You'd think she'd realize that, since her husband is a police officer, not a finance guru like some of the other men on the block.
Kat's a career woman, Doug says. That's always been true of her.
I don't know how long he and Wyatt have been listening. His comment is intended as support, but I feel like there's an undercurrent of him thinking I'm better at work than I am with Sadie. Sometimes I fear that myself.